Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mull.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mull. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
All right, today we are joined with a special guest. We've had quite a few guests on our show, but I'm guessing, Brandon, that this is going to be your favorite of the guests that we have.
Yeah, it's the most attractive guest we've had. It is my wife, Erlyn.
Erlyn, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you here and excited to chat with you. And this show is going to be all about your relationship with Brandon. No, we're not going to get into that stuff.
The finer points of slow dancing.
Yes. All that. No, today we're going to talk a little bit about, your professional relationship, that you two have. So, Brandon, tell me a little bit about, your professional relationship with Erlyn and what that looks like.
Yeah. So here's the thing. What an author needs more than anything else probably to succeed is a good editor. I mean, this is vital, fundamental. And I'm surrounded in my life by people who have helped me edit my books over the years. And I'm surrounded right now by people who have helped me edit books. You have helped me before. Natalie, your wife, has helped me before.
And Natalie, who's in the room with us, but not given a microphone.
And one thing I do when I have a close friend or a family member is I'll see how they do with an edit, you know? And so when I was dating Erlyn, as a single dad,
this is criteria for dating, is how they look at a book and give you notes.
Yeah. I give them a number two pencil and no. But but it was inevitable that when I found out that Erlyn liked to read and was really into books, that I wanted to see how she would do. So I gave her a chapter of one of the books I was working on to see what her feedback would be and see what it looked like. And when I got that chapter back, I was astonished. Because the edit was so brilliant. It was brilliant. And really showed a real aptitude for helping the manuscript say what it was trying to say, not just like catching commas, right? And so I could almost not believe it. And so I said, can you edit one more chapter? Because I had to see if this was like a one-hit wonder or lightning struck. But no, she did another chapter. Also brilliant.
Erlyn, had you gotten homework from a boyfriend before? Is this a new thing?
Brand new, Jason. And I was shocked when on a date, he said, hey, could you take a crack at this chapter for me? but I did it gamely and then I did it again. And I think it was only after the third chapter or so when he said trying to present me with another. And I said, oh, maybe we could do something else. And then he leaned in and
like
he said,
go to a movie,
yeah,
go out to dinner or something.
Then he leaned in and he said, what if I pay you?
Oh.
And as a single mom, I said, heck yeah, I'll keep the chapters coming.
Yeah, keep them coming. Tell me, what's your background in writing and English and that kind of stuff? Were you just a casual reader? Were you pursuing a vocation in writing or in editing or anything like that?
So I've always been a voracious reader. And I'd like to say that writing in journals is the only way that I got through my adolescence. Mm-hmm. I would just write everything out. Not so much journals to be preserved, to be read by posterity, as much as they were journals where I just spilled everything out, all my teenage angst, all the feelings I was having, just to get them outside of myself and to understand what was going on. So I had spent my youth reading and writing in abundance. And then I majored in English at BYU and then had seven kids. And reading was a huge part of the way I raised them. I would read with each one of them every day aloud until they were 13 or 14, 20 pages them, 20 pages me, mm-hmm. back and forth. I cherished that time, both for the time we spent together and for the time we spent sharing some of my favorite books. And so all these years, I had been honing and hearing the things that my kids would get tripped up on, and I would hear what their questions were, and we'd discuss the answers and look things up. And I didn't realize it over the process, but I had been really training my ear to, for dialogue for the written word, so that when I did pick up that first chapter that Brandon handed to me, it was easy. It felt like this invisible skill set that I had fully developed just at my beck and call.
That's awesome. Why did you choose English to major in? Was it something that you stumbled into, or were you thinking career at that point?
No, you know, my dad was an English major and he always taught us to turn our, he majored in English because it was his worst subject. He said, turn our strengths, our weaknesses into strengths. But for me, I just really had an affinity for English. I don't know what I was planning to do with it, just that I really loved working with it for those years.
Awesome. Now, Brandon, I know you've had, like you mentioned before, you have a lot of editors that take a look at what you do. What is, and I'm sure they all have different skills and talents and,
yes,
and what you look for them to do. For Erlynn, what is the thing that you want most out of the notes you get back from her, which is going to be different than the notes you get back from Eve versus Lisa or versus whoever else, right?
Yeah. So what I got from Erlynn was the closest thing I had ever gotten from a friend to a professional edit. I mean, she was doing the kind of editing that I get from Lisa at Simon & Schuster or from other editors at other publishers, the professionals. She was giving me that thorough of an edit. And the heart of that is helping the manuscript say what it's trying to say. Mm-hmm. A really good editor is, at the end of the day, they're trying to help the manuscript have the impact, the desired impact that the writer was trying to code into the prose, right? And so, like, one way to look at it is this. Orson Scott Card gave me really good editing advice on what you want from a reader. And that advice was, he said, I only have my readers mark two things. Mark if you got bored, and mark if something was unclear to you. Mm-hmm. Right. And sometimes we think about, you know, like, hey, I think punctuation, always mark that if you see messed up, a misspelled word. But what he was most interested in, because he knew there was a copy editor at the publisher who's going to catch most of those commas, right? But what he wanted to make sure of was, is the story I'm telling coming across in a way that the reader can understand? And if three people mark that a certain passage is unclear, or if two people didn't understand the motivation of a character, or if a couple of people all got bored at the same part, you now have a signal that your book's not doing something you thought it was doing, mm-hmm. right? Either you're boring people because you made a scene over descriptive or too long or whatever, not enough was happening, not enough tension in the scene. Or if it's unclear, your words aren't accomplishing the goal you set out to accomplish. And what Erlynn was bringing to the edit was catching a lot of stuff like that. I think you mean this, or I think you're trying to say this, or is this what you mean? And like, man, like you, when you edit my books, when Jason edits my books, what he's bringing often is seeing opportunities mm-hmm. that I missed, right? Which is a certain kind of thing. And so like the kind of stuff I get from you isn't the kind of stuff I really get from any other editor. And there's a lot of value there, because sometimes the stuff that you notice where there's an opportunity, there's a genuine opportunity and I take advantage of it point it out, you know? But with Erlynn, it was more like just the comprehensive, help the manuscript do what it's trying to do, like a professional level kind of edit. And so I feel like now I have this huge advantage, because I basically get some friend edits from people who are giving me, you know, their different expertise on different kind of reactions. But I'm also getting basically two professional edits, one from Erlynn and one from whoever the publishing house has selected as an editor for the current project.
That's awesome. Erlynn, from your perspective, when you are reading Brandon's manuscripts, what is it like for you? What's going on in your head? What are you looking for? What are those moments where something triggers for you and you go, oh, I've got to address this, right? This isn't working, and why? What are some of those things that you're looking for?
Yeah, so sometimes I feel like characters aren't being true to themselves with what they say or how they say it. Mm-hmm. So some of my edits fall under the, you know, that umbrella of, I'm not sure this is what the character would say, frankly. Like, I don't believe you. I don't believe this is how she would respond. You know, it's not quite there yet for me.
Yeah, the plot is making them say this, not who they are.
Yeah, like, I get that you need her to say mm-hmm. this, but is this really what she would say? I also like for, in conversations between like a hero figure and a villain figure, I like both the hero and the villain, both of their parts to be written as though they are the only part. Some writers will kind of give their villain the less good lines. They won't put as much heart mm-hmm. into the development of their villain's theories and thoughts and assertions. And I really like for to, to give all the energy of thought to the hero when they're speaking and then do the exact same treatment to the villain or the antagonist when they're speaking. So sometimes I'll call out things like that, like, okay, he can do better than this. He can muster, he would have a better reason than this here. And sometimes it's where there can be a misread. I'll catch a lot of things like that. Or I spend a lot of time trying to understand what the author is trying to say. If it's Brandon, you know, first I'll clarify, okay, is this what you're trying to say? Then as soon as I have a good understanding of that, I feel like I can become the machine they need me to be to totally help them execute that idea on the page. So I feel like my first task is really understanding what are you trying to say? And then my job is forget what I want to say as Erlynn. I need to step in as a shadow figure for them and help them be true to what they're trying to say throughout.
Awesome. Brandon, you mentioned you having this like two editors, right? And or professional editors to look at this. How important is it for you when you turn in that manuscript to the publisher that even though it's a first draft that they're seeing, that you're really putting forth something that is above what it should be at that level? Does that make sense?
Yeah, this is true for any writer. When you give an editor a book, that is what they have to work with. And whatever you give them, they're going to make it better. Mm-hmm. They're going to do everything they can to make it better. And usually most professional editors have a pretty strong skill set to succeed at that. I've always had really good feedback from the professional editors I've worked with. Almost no complaints. You know what I mean? Like it's been really useful. So the question is, do I want them to take something fair and make it good? Something good and make it great, something great and make it excellent, right? Like they're going to up level whatever I give them, but they're not going to take it from good to excellent. You know what I mean? Well, they can give me a big, strong uptick on whatever I turn in. And so the challenge on me is turn in the cleanest, best work I possibly can so that hopefully they're taking something great and making it excellent.
That's awesome. Do you guys get in fights over some
Absolutely,
of these?
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
Tell me about that.
At its most tense, it's almost like we're both lawyers mm-hmm. arguing for our point of view with a given edit, and it can become tense. It can become antagonistic. We're usually very professional, but at times it can be very heated, and we might even need to take a break. But you know, we almost always arrive at a better conclusion than where we started in those situations. You know, sometimes he or I will have to lawyer and advocate hard for our point. But the great thing is, as soon as he understands or I do, as soon as we see the better way or what would be better for the manuscript, one or the other of us will go with it. We'll just yield our will to the good of the whole.
Yeah, it's not about winning at that exactly. point. It's about making sure the book wins.
The reason the debate is happening is we both have a point of view on what will be best mm-hmm. for the story. And when that point of view is different, it becomes the job of the one to convince the other. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I mean, I do this with my professional editors too. Like, goodness, 80, 90% of what they give me is just straight up, yeah, that's better. Yeah, that's better. But every now and then they didn't see what I was trying to do mm-hmm. and their edit might work against what I was trying to do a little bit. And so then that's when it's very important for me to speak up because I don't want the thing to get out of my voice or to lose sight of what I'm trying to do. And then I speak up and explain what I'm trying to do. And usually the result of that is some kind of compromise. Usually because they flagged it, there's some issue there that needs to be improved or resolved. But often it's not necessarily their first instinct on how to resolve it isn't always the right one. Sometimes it'll be a compromise.
Yeah, I know. I've had the opportunity to see Erlynn in action a little bit where speaking of the Tanner Lowry project that you did years ago and seeing her notes versus what your agent said and others and seeing kind of that, I don't want to say vindication or whatnot, but tell me about that experience, Erlynn, when you see the notes that he's getting from Lisa or from others, and it lines up with what you're saying. What does that do for you when you experience that?
Well, it's very validating because Brandon's a very smart guy and he has many years of experience doing this and doing it extremely well. You know, long before I came on the scene to help him as an editor, he's been producing New York Times bestselling books. So it's very validating when something that I saw that was harder for him to see is is mirrored in other people's comments. And I think we're all learning. And honestly, one of my favorite things, Jason, is when I get back, when I see the edits that he gets back from an editor who I admire and respect, you know, like Lisa Mangum at Shadow Mountain or Lisa at Random House. I study their edits. I learn. I've learned so much from these other editors who I respect. Certain, they're just ingenious. They have ingenious instincts on certain things. You know, all of them do certain things really well. And so I just look at it as like a logic puzzle. Okay, wow, she's making things really fluid. She's always putting things in the exact right order for flow. Lisa Mangum is a master at this. And so I just make it my job, see what she's doing, figure it out, incorporate it, make it your own. The thing I really like about Lisa at Random House, she pushes Brandon more than any other editor I've ever seen. And guess what? Even this guy needs to be pushed. His work will be better for having been pushed. Sometimes I wonder if one of the things that I bring to Brandon is that I'm not afraid to push him and challenge him in some areas. And if that's true, you know, some of these other ladies, they do that to even greater extent. And his work is so much better off as a result.
That's awesome. I didn't even think about that opportunity that you have to look at professionals in this industry, because most people don't get that opportunity to see what a professional editor has to say about a book and what type of feedback is actually important and helpful versus what's not. That's pretty cool. What is your method? Are you kind of give me a printed version and I'm going to take out the colored pencils and do stuff, or are you on a computer typing notes on there? What's your preference?
Yeah, I like everything in hard copy. I'm old fashioned that way. I like to get it in my hands. I like to get a colored marker, and then I just make a lot of typical editorial notes that are consistent with industry standards. And then I write my own things in the margin. If I have suggestions or longer thoughts, I'll jot them down, sometimes scribbling them down on the backs of pages. Sometimes I'll look things up. I'll cross-reference things with his other books. But for the most part, I'd like to get it all down, written down on a hard copy in front of me, and then go over it with Brandon. And if I can, sometimes we edit in real time. We don't have the time for me to be prepped with material beforehand. That's fine too. So we can edit real time, but I prefer to have it prepared and ready mm-hmm. to go.
Yeah. And I'm sure, Brandon, that's an advantage for you too, to actually live with an editor so that you can have longer conversations with this. I remember being on a Zoom call with you and Lisa once about a book that you have coming up, and saw that early edit phase and what that looks like, that conversation looks like. And that call lasted about an hour, but you have more time with Erlynn. What does that time do for you?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any other editor where I have that kind of prolonged access where we can real time chew up how to make it better together. And that is such an advantage, because here's the thing. When you first write the book, you have this vision in your mind. And the vision that I have in my mind is always much superior to what I'm able to encode into words, right? But I'm hoping that what I've encoded into words will then decode into something like the vision I had when someone else reads it, that they can use what I've written as prompts to return to something awesome in their head, which is where I started, with something awesome in my head, right? And the problem there is sometimes there's noise and interference. I'm not encoding it right. And, you know, I'm not like it, like what I'm saying isn't getting them sometimes anywhere near to what I was seeing in my mind. And that can be so valuable to know, because see, I have the cheat of seeing in my head already the story.
Right.
And so I don't necessarily ever get to see what it feels like to know nothing about the story and try to use my words to get back there. And so to have people who are smart doing that for me is essential to finding the blind spots, the things that I thought were on the page that just weren't there and were only in my head and never were conveyed in the words, right? And sometimes it's actually scary to realize, like, you know, when someone asks some questions, I go, I just didn't put in enough clues to get them where I wanted them. And I had no idea I didn't put in enough clues. But now that someone...
And that's why they're called blind spots. It's because you don't know what you don't know, right? You don't know what you didn't communicate. Yeah.
So it feels like such a gift to be alerted to places where the manuscript is not communicating what I wanted it to communicate. And to be able to like go over that real time with somebody with some back and forth lets me ask those questions. Well, what did you see? Like, what did you not see? Oh, you didn't see this. Well, would this get you there? And then, you know, after we've talked about it enough, then it's going to take a fresh pair of eyes to see if we actually succeeded. Right. But but it gets me, I know that working with Erlynn gets me so much closer to the manuscript actually saying what I'm trying to say.
It is an advantage that we have so much access to each other. However, I do so much help with Brandon developing concepts, ideas, and world building. We'll make diagrams. We'll write in notebooks, different ideas for his upcoming books, plot lines, character development, that sometimes when I edit, there's a danger of me having the benefit of knowing all this world building. And we'll have to ask each other, wait, Erlynn, do you know just what I'm trying to say here, but is that because you helped me develop these concepts, you know, and we'll kind of have to strip it down a little bit. So there is that too.
The more she's helped with some of the pre-writing, the more she knows some of the spoilers.
Right.
The more,
and the more blind spots she'll have all of a sudden in that situation.
Her objectivity as a fresh pair of eyes gets compromised. Yeah. Right. But there's always value that she brings, sure. But that's partly why also I always show it to some friends and some family along with my professional editors. Cause after my professional editors have been working with it long enough, they're going to have the same blind spots I do,
yes.
You know, before long. And there's no substitute for a fresh pair of eyes for finding those blind spots.
Awesome. I know a lot of people who listen to this podcast are aspiring writers who want to get into this industry. What kind of advice do both of you guys have on having this type of relationship? It doesn't have to be with a spouse. It can be with a spouse, but with a close friend, when you're not quite at that professional level yet, but you want to take your book to the next level and get ready to go. How do you make this happen?
For me, I mean, I would say I spent my whole life curating good editors around me. Like, and I ran a comedy troupe at BYU, and some of those people in that comedy troupe that like to read prose, I found could give me really great feedback. I've been in writing groups in college sometimes where I was with people who had such a different point of view than me and such different sensibilities than me, that I found very little value in their feedback. And after some of those experiences, I was like, oh, I've got to be careful about who I listen to. Like, I got to find somebody where we're in sync enough that I can trust their voice. Right. And that doesn't mean that they're only telling me positive things, mm-hmm. but what it means is that when they tell me something, I can make sense of it. Cause sometimes I get feedback from certain people that I just couldn't make sense of. Mm-hmm. And I don't want that to be a steady voice in my editing process. Right. And so it was paying attention to people whose feedback I could make sense of and it felt beneficial. And, you know, if you make an effort to find anything, I think you can usually find it. It's just about making that effort. And because I was serious about writing, I made that effort for years. And like, and that was partly why when I got an edit from Erlynn, I was like, wait a minute.
There's something here.
I have people give me edits and it's never at this level. And so if I were a new writer, I would just be paying attention to who are my friends and some of the people who give me, I had an Uncle Tuck who's passed away. He would always give me an exhaustively overly thorough edit, sometimes tedious, truly tedious things that he would bring up. And there was probably, it was so thorough and so exhaustive and so tedious that probably half of it I wouldn't take, but all of it at least made sense.
Right.
All of it was thoughtful. And the half I did take would benefit the book hugely. And he would make catches that no other editor made. I'm sure there's some catches that'll never be made now in my future because Tuck's gone, mm-hmm. you know, but like different people do have different strengths. And while that really exhaustive edit was tedious, I so miss it because there was always some great catches in there. You know what I mean? And sometimes the great catch was as simple as just a better verb.
Yeah.
Or a better word. And I just never would have had that better word. And it just made the image or the moment pop a little more. And it doesn't have to be a huge thing, right? But like when anybody can give me feedback where I go, oh, that's a little better. It's such a gift mm-hmm. because it makes me look smarter than I am. And it makes the book work better than it would have.
Yeah, that's great.
We have this old story in my family of origin back from when I was a kid where my older brother, Mark, was giving a prayer, just a nightly family prayer. And he said a few simple things. And at the end of it, I turned to my mom at like age 6 and I said, humph, he used the word good 3 times. And so, you know, kind of a snotty little girl, right? But my advice is use all of your opportunities with language to get better at using language, even in prayers, even in conversation. I remember going on long drives with my grandmother when I was in college and she was ailing, and there was not much to talk about. But I remember looking upon it as a sort of special challenge for myself, asking myself, come on, Erlyn, draw out the story in her, get her talking. What if you needed to, you know, like to stay alive? What if you needed to live? What if your life depended on this kind of a thing? And it was amazing how much my skills changed as I pushed myself to say something better. You know, you try to comfort someone who's going through the grief process. You say something wrong. You say something clumsy. Guess what? Those are the first steps in the process of, you know, saying something closer to right, saying something that they can interpret as heartfelt, as loving, something that tells them you care. Sometimes even in texting, and this depends on how fast my life is going at the moment, sometimes I'll take pride in my texts and I'll edit them and I'll say things with a cute turn of phrase. Sometimes commenting on social media. In the past, I've challenged myself, say something humorous in just one liner, Lynn. You know, say something funny, say something that perfectly shows that you perfectly read and heard what they said in this beautiful essay. And I'll challenge myself to make a 2-line blurb a work of art in whatever words I have at my disposal. So my advice, I think, is just upgrade from wherever you are, whether it's in conversation, whether it's a written note, do it better. Get more say more exactly what you're trying to say across the board, and your skills will develop. And if you get into a situation where, and hopefully this speaks to your original question, where you're collaborating with another person, refuse to have hurt feelings. And if your opinion isn't being validated, work harder, study harder, research harder, substantiate your side, your opinion, your assertions until like your assertions are so logical, are so sound that they cannot be ignored, or until they fall away because the other person was right, or because maybe they were weaker than you thought. But work harder. Don't resort to hurt feelings or angry words at any time. Keep your cool and just get a better skill set. That'll do all the work for you.
That's awesome. I want to get to hurt feelings in a second, but before I do, one thing that I've noticed about Erlyn and when we go on campouts or whatever is I feel like the adults will all get together and we'll have these same conversations over and over again. And Erlyn, on the other hand, always kind of pushes herself away from that group, hangs out with the kids, gets to know their stories and gets fascinated by their stories, and then tries to get us excited about the kids. And we're like, we're here to hang out with each other. We're here not to be with these kids. No, but it's a great power that you have to look for story, to look for points of view, and look for other things among people where sometimes they can go unnoticed or uncared and out of that comfort zone. So I can see how that could help you become a better editor too.
Thanks.
I do want to talk about hurt feelings because I work in an industry as well, where we will, I'll be producing a video and our editor or one of the editors I'm working with will give us a cut of their thing and it may not work. Right. And you're trying to give feedback that says, hey, this doesn't work. And you're basically saying this sucks, but you don't suck. Right. So how do you do that? How do you say, Brandon, what you wrote sucks, but Brandon, you don't suck, right? Or for you, Brandon, how do you hear that what you wrote doesn't work, but it's not a reflection of you personally? How do you separate those things?
Yeah, I'll start on this, and then you can say what you do. I'll start by saying the intention. The intention is to remember that when you're critiquing a manuscript, you're not critiquing the person. Mm-hmm. And it's important for everybody to just remember that. Like as the author, you got to remember that. As the editor, you have to remember that. Like what we're doing here is addressing this manuscript, this thing that has been built. How do we build it a little better? And that doesn't have to be terribly personal. Now, it inherently gets a little personal because there's a lot of things you might have an opinion about inside that manuscript. Something that you thought was funny or something that you really enjoyed in the manuscript that someone else might not think is funny or might not think works or might not think. And that can be frustrating because it makes you question your own judgment, which can sometimes make you question yourself a little bit. But the professional way to do this is just to remember, hey, this is something outside of me. These are words I put together outside of me, and we're just trying to make this thing that's outside of me the best it can be, right? So if I can stay in that place, then I can usually hear all sorts of criticism and try to really objectively just look at, like, this says nothing about me, but it says something about the manuscript. And are they right about what they're saying about the manuscript? Can I get behind it? And if I can I humbly improve it and just keep moving forward?
But do you still get hurt feelings every now and then?
Yes. It's inevitable. Like I've talked with other writers about this. Like when you send in your manuscript. Now, remember, when I send in a manuscript, I have spent months on this, mm-hmm. sometimes years planning it, preparing it. And it's sort of like you're sharing something that means a lot to you and that represents an enormous amount of work, something that you thought was cool and funny. And you thought it was all the things it was supposed to be. And for me, before I turn it in, I've done everything I can do to make it the best it can be. Everything that I can see at the time, right? I'm not sending it in if I still see flaws. Like I get to a place where I don't see flaws anymore. That's when I send it in. And so it's so painful mm-hmm. to get that first letter back from the editor where the primary focus is what's flawed, sometimes flawed, what's wrong with it. And I mean, for most of us, it takes a couple days to like get objective about that feedback.
Will I ever write a book again? And
yeah, because sometimes it's as simple as, oh, this is going to be so much work.
Sure.
I've done so much work already and I thought I was close to done and there's so much more work that's needed. Like the most painful thing is when they're very right. Mm-hmm. And it just means there's a lot of work you have to do to improve it. And no one wants to hear they have a bunch of extra work on something that felt done, right? So there's that alone. Then on top of it, there's all the little things that you're excited about that you're worried, oh, maybe that didn't hit like I thought, or maybe inherently what I think is cool isn't cool, or, you know, all these kind of self-doubt kind of things. And so it really is a mind game to share your work. And it really helps if you can stay in that place where I started of, okay, you know what? This is something I made and I made it as best as I could see. And now with other eyes on it, we're going to see how we can make this better. And to try to be grateful for that, because here's the thing. If the first draft of all my stuff came out as it was, I wouldn't even be known as a writer. You know what I mean? Right. Like a lot of this editing work is what got it to a place where it went from palatable to really tasty. You know what I mean? Like where, cause to succeed as a writer, your book's got to be good enough that somebody says, not only am I glad I paid with my time and money to read this, I'm going to suggest others do the same. You know, and think about how good that has to be for you to recommend a book to a friend. And that's the tall order for a writer, is to write a book so good that people are happy they read it. They're going to recommend it to a friend. And often that just takes, no matter how good you are, it takes a bunch of extra work in the editing phase. Right. And so to me, the big reward at the end is, hey, did all of this long process yield something that people can be excited about and have fun with? And realizing that that's the point of editing is so key to being a professional author.
Awesome. Erlynn, how do you not hurt feelings?
Yeah, well, I will say this. Of all the authors I've worked with, Brandon is very good at taking his corrections. He's very professional about not getting hurt feelings. So it's very nice to work with Brandon. However, what does happen with Brandon and I is sometimes dynamics from the rest of our life will spill over into the editing process. And, you know, if he's cranky or maybe I'm cranky about something else, sometimes it's a little bit harder. Sometimes that crankiness can spill over into a little bit of editing disagreement. We can get gridlocked a little bit. But I think that when we both understand we're looking for what's in the best interest of the manuscript, it's actually a huge relief. There have been many times when I do realize, oh, I see what he's saying. He doesn't need my edit. It's fine as it is. And as soon as you let that go, it can be very empowering. It can be a big relief. As an editor, you're holding all these tensions of, oh, this isn't quite right yet. And this doesn't make sense. And I'm not sure you want to say that. But if they can appease your worry and it can stay as is, and that relief can come, that is a success. So as an editor, I think it's important to realize that your edits getting implemented isn't the success. What represents the success, this is kind of the converse of what Brandon is saying, is, you know, coming to the best resolution. And so, you know, and sometimes it works for us just in a practical way to actually schedule editing hours to make sure that we look upon that time, you know, more seriously. This is work time. And it's, even though we're together all day, every day, this is different time than us cooking together in the kitchen or us talking or driving kids around. you see what I mean? That's been a helpful tool for us just to keep them separate.
Awesome. Well, it, when this podcast releases, it's going to be February, the month of love and Valentine's Day and all that. I don't know when, exactly when it's going to release in February, but we're slated for that. I want to talk a little bit about your relationship and specifically kind of the pros and cons of working together, right? Because I'm sure there's pros and cons of that. The pros and cons of having to have tough conversations at work, but those skills of communications, how they can bleed over into that relationship as well. So, Erlynn, why don't we start with you?
I'll tell you what's challenging, Jason. What's challenging is when we've had a particularly intense several hours of editing. Let's say it's been a 4-hour block where we've really been lawyering hard with each other, angling. You know, there's been a lot of disagreement about edits, but, you know, but we've been hacking through it. And at the end of that time, for me, I'm such an introvert, I kind of want to go hide for the break hour or two before we edit again. Whereas Brandon's like, hey, now let's go do something else together. And I'm like,
I don't want to be next to you.
Yeah. And it wouldn't matter that it's him or anyone.
Sure.
It's like, Brandon, I will not survive this unless I can go be in a cave for an hour and not see or hear anyone's voice.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So sometimes you need to recharge. It's definitely a hard thing. Like what she said about if we're interpersonally not in the best place when we start editing together, that's when there's a downside to, yeah, to having a relationship separate from the editing. Because think about it, when you're kind of mad at someone, or if your feelings are hurt about, yeah, something, you can be
a little spiteful and
you can be a little more pissy,
yeah, yeah,
and a little, and answer a little shorter or a little ruder. And like, and it doesn't take much of that to, when the pressure's on with an edit, to get into arguments and tempers. And like, there's been moments when we're like, it's not working right now. Like, yeah, like we have to both like calm down a little bit for this to work. Like, because in any relationship, there's only so much pressure you can handle. Right. Mm-hmm. And so like, if we're already under pressure on other things, sometimes the edit thing is just too much extra pressure. And there's been times when she's almost like, I don't know if we can do this. I don't know if I can keep editing for you. And especially like another thing, if I want to really mess things up, if I start trying to like kiss her or something, or if I'm like happy, cause we're editing and we're close. There's no place for that in editing.
Right. You know what I mean? Right.
Like very quickly. It's like
I'm a coworker right now.
Yeah.
Do we need to get an HR department in the Bull family? Yeah.
Yeah. Like I learned pretty quick, I think, that if we don't wear pretty professional hats in that mode, it's like an unlivable experience. For at least for Erlynn, yes, and maybe partly for me, if I'm being smart, you know,
yeah, yeah.
One thing that, yeah, I don't know. Is there other things you wanted to say about relationships? Just another thing that I think is kind of fun is seeing every editor also has their blind spots. And for me, like the funniest blind spot, for me was for the voice of my hermit trolls in my books, Bubda or Hermo in Fablehaven, like their broken, terrible English was just nightmarish for Erlynn. Is this not true?
Yeah. I remember saying, Brandon, this is where I draw the line. I won't edit Hermo's voice. And then I had to realize this is part of Brandon's unique genius, his ability to inhabit these juvenile voices, and his middle grade audience really loves him for this.
Yeah.
You know, another blind spot that goes along with that is some of this boy potty humor, like smell in Fablehaven. One of the punishments was the loser of some challenge had to smell the other kid's dirty socks. To me, yeah, you know what? In my home of origin, we didn't talk about dirty socks and potty humor. Those were considered like dirty words. So some of this middle grade humor, I just have to kind of smile and realize kids love this. It's okay if I'm not appreciating it. When I read these same books aloud with my own kids, I'm seeing them giggle and love Brandon for the inclusion of certain characters and certain material. So I just have to realize I don't understand it. It doesn't work for me. And it's part of his genius.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Tell me, you know, we've talked about arguing out different points of view when it comes to the edit and stuff. How have you taken that ability to communicate and share your thoughts and feelings when it's your relationship and has nothing to do with the book? Having those skills and developing them professionally together, how has that translated outside of the professional realm and into the actual relationship? Do you guys feel like you can talk about things and hit hard topics together? Or
Jason, the crash course is 11 kids together in a blended family, all in their adolescence when we got married. That was the masterclass on communication. Every one of them is at all times, at least one of them is in a crisis, right? You know, and some of them are in a depression, and some of them are in a funk. And like, you know, sometimes there's blame for the other family who's blended with theirs. And so that has been the crucible for us to refine these.
More so than the editing.
Yes, it's gone the other way. And I think as we've gotten better and better at communicating through these really emotional issues that relate to people we love so much, that's transferred into editing. And we've become way more clear-headed about just giving the factual, you know, having the factual editing interaction.
Something that's really helped me in those interactions, and this is, I think it's good for any human, is learning to actually trust and respect the other person's judgment. Because sometimes I can have a tendency to think, because I see it in a way that feels really clear to me, I must be right. Mm-hmm. Right. And this, I mean, this is true in editing. This is true in life. And I have learned that if there's something that she feels different than me about, it can be really valuable to actually shut up and really listen, like listen hard, because she often, like, at bare minimum is making a good point. And sometimes she's just flat out, it's just a flat out clear, better point than I'm making if I really stop and think about it. And so, like, for me, it's been, and this is really useful for almost any author, learn to listen, right? Like sometimes we're prepared, like sometimes we treat it like when you're editing a book, it's not really a debate. It can turn into a debate, but the point isn't to win a debate. The point isn't to win your point. The point is to make the book better. And so, like, if you're not seeing and weighing both sides of that debate, you aren't doing your job, right? If you're just trying to win your point, you're not doing your job. And I think that that's true, like, in family issues too, right? Like, mm-hmm. if I'm not really seeing where she's coming from, and I'm just trying to treat it like a debate, the point of blending our families through marriage wasn't to win an argument, wasn't to win the day. It was to make things work for everybody. And that happens way more by, like, listening. And then that's been, man, like, as a kind of a hard-headed guy, that's been a really valuable lesson to learn, is it's like, listen and incorporate the good judgment coming your way before you're preparing your rebuttals.
Yeah. Well, Brandon, you mentioned earlier, sometimes getting edits kind of gets you down, right? There's a lot of work that has to come. Tell me about the opposite edits that you get, where you hear something and you're like, oh my gosh, like that works, and it's going to change everything. And I'm excited for this change. I'm excited for this work. Tell me about those moments, and how often those come compared to the I got to go back to work moments.
We're trying so hard. I'm trying so hard to make the book awesome, to make the book fun, to make the book worth reading, to have experiences as you read the book. And so when something adds, elements that make the book more enthralling or more entertaining or more interesting, and that can be little things like better words and better turns of phrase. It can be big things like a story opportunity that I didn't see, or how the addition of a new character can transform some chapters, right? I just experienced that I'm working on a book that's going to come out probably in 26, called The Forbidden Mountain. Mm-hmm. That's a big epic fantasy adventure kind of story. And there was some, I had a lot of cool things in that book, but as I added a couple new characters that were a little more compelling, some compelling side characters, it brought certain storylines to life and, like, added new cogs to certain storylines. That was very exciting and fun to implement. And so maybe I could sum it up like this. Seeing what you did poorly, I don't know how to make that fun.
Right.
Right. Like, if someone's pointing out what I did poorly, that part of it is always going to feel like a firing squad. Mm-hmm. It just feels, it's not super fun. I'm grateful for that too. I don't want to have poor work. And if someone can point out something poor that I can then fix, that feels good. But like, it's the making it better that feels exciting. When like someone might've pointed out something that I did poorly, but as I find a solution to that, and as I see how that makes things better, that's thrilling. That's really exciting. And I'm very aware that like, look, when I say this when I go to schools and talk to kids, when you're having a conversation with your friend and your friend says something mean, gives you a put down. And if a half an hour later you think of that great comeback, there is no cool way to use that comeback ever. It's like the moment's passed. You don't get to use it. It's too late. And that's such a frustrating feeling sometimes to be like, oh, I should have said this. And it would have been A, it would have been funny, or B, it would have like put them in their place, or, you know, whatever the goal was. Right. Maybe both those things ideally, but like when you're editing a book, you can think of the comeback a half an hour later and still use it.
Or a month later,
a year later, and you can still use it. And for the reader, that happened the first time, mm-hmm. right? Because you're outside of time when you're writing that book. Until it's out there published and readers are having that experience, anything you fix or improve, that's their first experience with it. So you have an extra half an hour or an extra day or an extra week or extra month or an extra year to think of a better way to describe that moment, or to think of a better comeback for a character, or to think of a more eloquent way something could be said. And to have all that time and still get to use it, that is how editing makes you look smarter than you actually are. If you take advantage of that principle.
I always know when Brandon really likes one of my edits, because we'll be working and he'll be typing on his computer. And even though the computer is set to autosave, when he really likes an edit, he'll quickly press the save icon as soon as we incorporate the edit, like just to make sure it doesn't slip away before it autosaves again.
Yeah, you're right. That is one of my tells. Uh-huh. And there's so often when Erlen gives me really brilliant edits, and there's been times when you and Natalie have given me really brilliant edits over the years. I mean, you guys have edited for me longer than Erlen has as far as duration in my career, because I've known you guys longer. But yeah, it's always such a beautiful feeling when those edits are good and when it makes things better.
Awesome. Well, I think we're going to close there. Erlen, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for being an awesome guest on Mulling It Over with Brandon Mull. Anything that you guys are working on now, anything that you guys want to plug before we close?
I mean, Erlen is always also doing freelance edits for other people, but we won't make this about that.
Yeah. If you'd like Erlen to edit your stuff.
Yeah. But like, the stuff that we've been working on is just the stuff that I have coming out. So I have a book about Newell and Doran, the satyrs, the Fablehaven satyrs, that's kind of funny and fast paced.
Do you have a date for that yet?
Yeah, that comes out at the end of February.
Okay, so this month.
Yeah. So end of February, start
perfect
of March.
Month to talk about it.
Tales of Newell and Doran will release, and it's a fable novel in the Fablehaven world. It's fast and funny, and that one should be. I had a lot of fun writing it. We had a lot of fun. It came really fast and easy because I think I just knew those characters in that story world well, right. And it just feels like it should be a crowd pleaser. So I hope that'll be true. We'll see what happens.
Awesome. Erlen, anything from you?
No, Jason, thank you for having me. I will say, I think editing is what brought Brandon and I together. He was dating a lot of women back in the day.
A lot of women.
Yeah. Hey. And you know, there came a day when he said to me, Erlen, if this doesn't go your way, like if I marry someone else, will you still edit for me? And I just said, no. At a week or two later, proposal came.
That's good. That's a smart editor right there. Yeah.
Yep. And maybe a smart author. Who knows?
Well, speaking of editors, we have a awesome editor on this podcast. His name is Carter Brown. He does all the post-production and editing for this. So we just like to thank Carter for his hard work, and it makes it easier for us to do our thing. So Carter, thank you for the work that you do on this show. And we'll end this episode of Mulling It Over with Brandon Mull.
fellow adventurers. I am Jason Conforto.
And I'm Tyler Crump, and we are hosts of a podcast, Adventure AI, where we play Dungeons & Dragons with an AI named Alex the Language Lord.
I'm Alex the Language Lord. Join us as we craft epic tales together.
Do you want to learn how to use AI in your D&D campaign?
Or how AI can force you to do things that you don't want to do? Wait a second. We don't like that.
Look no further. Adventure AI is the podcast for all your AI-powered D&D adventures.
Alex the Language Lord not only comes up with campaigns for us,
he also helps us create our characters, create our backstories, and even give us some fun magical items.
And really takes all of the human aspects out of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's not really playing at all.
Follow Adventure AI on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.